BCFM is the award-winning community radio station for Bristol, and it's here to give everybody in Bristol a voice. BCFM 93.2. Bristol is our community. Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show, Friday Drive Time, with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Pin back your ears, because 10 years on, you won't be hearing the reasons for a new investigation into the 9/11 attacks on the BBC. British media coverage of the 10th anniversary of the 9/11 has not touched on many of the factual errors put out by, guess who? The British media, during the first hours and days after the attacks. Neither has addressed how the Bush administration supposedly discovered on the same day that Osama bin Laden done it. For example, did CNN and the BBC both announce the collapse of World Trade Center Building 7 25 minutes before it was actually brought down by controlled demolition? Hard evidence, many say, that the 9/11 was a choreographed public spectacle with the purpose of providing NATO with a pretext to invade Central Asia. The 10th anniversary coverage has also been notable for branding those who point out these sorts of factual errors as conspiracy theorists. Well, we're having none of that, and we will be hearing some more eyewitness evidence that contradicts the official account of events that day, and recommending one or two well-researched and referenced books. And also we're looking at architects, firefighters and websites of other professionals which tell the story of what really happened. And also, you may not have heard about these 9/11 authors on the BBC and other mainstream press. But first, Ulster is going through right now its first supergrass trial for more than a decade. Martin Summers, I'm going to ask him now to fill us in a bit about what it tells us about the Troubles. Now, Martin, this trial, I mean, we had quite a few supergrass trials, certainly to do with criminality in London, and also some in Northern Ireland more than 10 years ago and during the Troubles. Why is it that this is such a special case?
Well, it's a repeat of what we've seen before, where basically in order to get convictions, top terrorists or alleged terrorists turn informer and incriminate all their former former associates, and in this case it's loyalist terrorists, and the diplot court system that used to exist basically then convicted people on the say-so of these informers and sent them down. And it was basically supergrass trials were developed and diplot courts were developed because of the fear of jury tampering. And of course, hopefully, we're moving into an era where these will gradually die away and they won't be necessary anymore because we've actually got a genuine peace agreement.
One of the problems with this, of course, was that this ex-UVF member was, whilst he was killing people, was also a paid police informer.
Well, that's normal stuff. I mean, the head of the UDA intelligence section... I didn't know the name and it's escaping from me. Brian Nelson, he was the UDA's chief intelligence officer in the 1980s, 1990s, and he basically chose who was going to be killed. And it turned out he was working for the British Army's Force Research Unit. His handler was Brigadier Gordon Kerr, who's now in Iraq. And basically, the British were telling him who to kill, and he went out and killed them, including possibly Pat Finucane.
So, how is it that how do the police actually manage these people? Surely they shouldn't be paying informers if those informers are actually murdering.
Well, I mean, as we know, in relation to the 7/7 case, Tony, the bombings in London in 2005, there was a mastermind named by the Metropolitan Police, which is Harun Rashid Aswat. Omar.
Actually, I don't think it's the Met that named him. It was John Loftus.
John Loftus named him as an MI6 double agent. It was the Met that had named him as the mastermind. Now, in other words, it's quite possible that the guy who masterminded 7/7 was himself an MI6 agent. Now, is that MI6 infiltrating Al Qaeda or is that MI6 directing Al Qaeda?
So, how do we know the difference?
Well, how do you know the difference? Good question.
And it seems that there's a similar comparison here to what was what's going on in Northern Ireland then?
Indeed. I mean, this is the way the world really works, folks. This is how sausages are made. If you don't like what it looks like, look away now. Basically, there's always a case for infiltrating organisations that you want to try and, you know, spy on. But at what point does that infiltration become direction? The Red Brigades, for example, were infiltrated, and the kidnapping and assassination of the Prime Minister Aldo Moro in Italy in 1979 was actually carried out ostensibly by the Red Brigades, but was in fact an Italian state operation, because Moro was about to invite the Communist Party into the government, and various bigwigs in the intelligence community were not happy with that, so he was kidnapped supposedly by the Red Brigades and then shot. But of course it actually turned out after investigation that this was not in fact it was a Red Brigades operation, but the Red Brigades were themselves infiltrated. This is the kind of thing that goes on. I mean, if you talk to people in pubs in Belfast on either side of the line, they understand how it works. But of course, many British people on this side of the water find it all rather mysterious. But I'm afraid that's the real world that really works. I mean, basically, infiltration and informers and whispers in ears and so on is very much how it works.
Now, in the Belfast Telegraph today, we have a headline: Supergrass trial. I lied to police, admits witness. A star witness in the Lawless Supergrass case has admitted telling a blooming great whopper to police investigating the murder of UDA chief Tommy English. Ex-UVF member Robert Stewart said he deliberately left out evidence about two of the accused in the account he gave to police back in 2008. Stewart, an alcoholic and former habitual drug taker, made the admission during the third day of the trial in Langside Courts, but the 37-year-old is giving evidence against alleged UVF commander and former police agent Mark Haddock and 13 other defendants. Insisted he was not the shooter of Mr. English in October 2000. Now, is this the sort of thing that sort of court case that actually could have happened, do you think, Martin, during the Troubles? Or is it the fact that we've had the peace process, the peace agreement, that's now allowing some of these cases to be looked at again?
Well, I mean, this is a recent case. I mean, this is internal fighting within the Loyalist paramilitaries that we're talking about here. I mean, you know, it's not a very savoury world, and it's a very unsavoury situation. But I wouldn't like to say too much about the case because I don't know enough of the detail. I mean, I know about historical cases in the past, but this, of course, is a case that's still in progress. I mean, you know, basically, we've got to establish a normal situation in Northern Ireland where basically the law is enforced impartially and everybody respects it. And if this helps this process to come forward, then that's fine. But I mean, there's always been shortcuts in Northern Ireland with the intelligence services not just making mistakes, but actually, in fact, possibly making things worse. So that, for example, the bombings of Monaghan and Dublin in 1972 are widely believed by the Irish police and the Republic to have been orchestrated by British intelligence operatives.
So how do we know who's done a bomb attack when it happens?
We don't, is a simple answer, and therefore you shouldn't presume that you do know. I mean, basically, it usually takes a very long time to investigate these kind of events. Sometimes it's easy, because the IRA, for example, had a system where P. O'Neill, who was their imaginary spokesperson in Dublin, would issue a statement saying that they had in fact carried out an attack. And the IRA always claimed their own attacks because they didn't want anybody to be under any doubt who had done anything. Or they would never, obviously they didn't say who individually had done it, but they said yes, this is or this is not an IRA operation. I think what we've got with Islamist terrorism, the English Defence League and Breivik killing people in Norway, there's all sorts of nasty structures out there, and people shouldn't presume that the intelligence services are just there to help them. The intelligence services are quite often implicated in these kind of events, which is why investigations should be carried out by independent police, not by the intelligence services. They're often suspects.
Do you think these are official operations which are signed off by the government then, or is this rogue elements within?
What happens is if you've got a politician at the top of the top of the tree, you deliberately don't tell them what's going on, because then they can come out honestly and say they don't know, even though they may suspect. In Italy, Francesco Cossiga, who was implicated in Gladio, who's a former president of Italy, he's on the record in Corriere della Sera, which is their version of the Daily Telegraph, saying, well, it's well known in intelligence circles that Mossad and the CIA carried out 9/11. And he was a Gladio insider. His colleagues inside Gladio must be very unhappy with him. He's one of those people that turns up in the pub and blags on about how they carried out the robbery. They've shut him up now, but I'm afraid things do come out in that kind of way.
So it sounds like a an argument really for more oversight for the intelligence services, but of course they will argue national security. You can't have a
well, you can't have the public strolling in. That's the problem, isn't it? They create incidents which then create fear, which then leads to extra powers for the intelligence services, which then gives them more power to create further incidents, to create more fear, to get more power. It's a fairly straightforward process. We saw the, a similar thing happen, that chap that died of polonium poisoning, Litvinenko. If you read his book, Blowing Up Russia, he's saying the FSB, I was an FSB agent, we bombed Moscow and Ryazan in September 1999, and that's another anniversary that's coming up. This is September. We did all of that. It wasn't the Chechens. We blamed it on the Chechens, and we used it as a means to aggrandise power to the FSB in Russia. Now, that's the Russians doing it. Bombings of Monaghan and Dublin, that's the British doing it. Bombing of Bologna railway station, that's the Italians with the British doing it. Because, of course, when you're talking about the Italian intelligence services, we're basically talking the British and the Americans. They're the senior services. So there's a documented track record of our own intelligence services being engaged in provocations of this kind. It's not conspiracy theory, it's all on the record. Not that you will find it on mainstream television. There was, of course, the Gladio films on BBC Two in 1993, shown once and then buried in the memory hole. Most people blink once and you've missed it. All the information's out there, but most people are misdirected away from it.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
On to the 10th anniversary of 9/11 now, and Martin Summers, we're rather lucky to have you here all the time, but also particularly because you're one of the coordinators of this Reinvestigate 9/11 campaign. Can you just tell us briefly why you got involved in that?
Well, I mean, we set up Reinvestigate 9/11 because we wanted to push for a proper investigation, because the investigation that's been carried out so far is frankly a whitewash, like many other investigations, like the investigation of Bloody Sunday, for example, in this country. We've also set it up because we want to actually talk to opinion formers, politicians, military, police, people at the senior levels, and educate them about the nature of what's going on. And we don't want to be spending a lot of time talking about fringe theories. We just want to focus on basically the military intelligence aspects of this event.
So let's go back to the time around September the 11th itself and have a listen to, first of all, George Bush actually declaring the war on terror, and then after that, it's Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, who at the time was Colin Powell, who's the Defence Secretary's Chief of Staff.
Our war on terror begins with Al-Qaeda, but it does not end there.
We have made much more than a cottage industry out of what my former boss Colin Powell has called the terrorist industrial complex. Lots of people are making lots of money off of this so-called global war on terror.
The terrorist industrial complex. Now, you mentioned the military industrial complex, Martin. What is it?
Well, I mean, the military industrial complex is the relationship between big arms companies and arms dealers and the military and the governments of the day who chuck taxpayers' money down that great big yawning hole. The terrorist industrial complex. Do you realise there's nearly 1 million people, I believe, employed in the Homeland Security system in the United States, all of whom have security clearance? There's a forest of initials, things like the Joint Services Group in Iraq, headed up by our own Brigadier Gordon Kerr. What does the Joint Services Group do? I don't know. What does a Joint Services Group do? They just do things, but we don't know what. And we can't know because it's secret. Now, what we really need is efficient police and intelligence services, which are absolutely accountable. And since we've got documented misbehaviour by our own intelligence services, it's time we had a serious look at who they are and who's running them.
Yeah. Now, Mayor Rudy Giuliani on September the 11th itself actually did, later on that day, a tour of New York. Rudy Giuliani had also been involved in... he was friendly with a guy called Larry Silverstein. Larry Silverstein actually bought the World Trade Center just beforehand and actually made a fantastic amount of money out of the attacks.
He did. It wasn't just him. It was a consortium of businessmen led by Larry Silverstein. Because, of course,
they had the buildings insured.
Well, the World Trade Center was, in fact, owned by the New York Port Authority, so it was a public sector structure. And 6 weeks before the attack, it was privatised to a private consortium of businessmen led by Silverstein and also, I understand, including Rupert Murdoch. And then they insured the buildings against terrorist attack. And then, wow, there was a terrorist attack. So they managed to clean up on the insurance.
They tried to claim twice, didn't they?
Yeah, they tried to claim that there was two terrorist attacks so they should have got double insurance. The insurance companies knocked them back on that one, but they still got a very hefty payout. And don't forget, they'd never even paid the money for the buildings at that stage. So you say, yes, we're going to buy these buildings, we'll pay you the money later, then the buildings get knocked down, and then you get an insurance payout. That insurance payout would have gone to the state of New York if these people hadn't interposed themselves. Think about that. Yeah, if the buildings had still been publicly owned and were insured against terrorist attack, all of that money would have gone to the state of New York. In actual fact, it went into the pockets of these private businessmen. I think that rates a don't you?
One of the things we keep hearing is that everything has changed after 9/11. In fact, some of their political leaders at the time were saying the world has changed. Do you think the world really has changed?
Well, it did, because it was a deliberately orchestrated event to change it. And, you know, various things have flowed from that event, have they not?
Orchestrated by who?
Well, that's a good question. That's what an investigation should find out. We at Reinvestigate do not claim that we know what happened on 9/11. We don't. What we do know is that the official story, as presented, it cannot be correct. And I was actually interviewed this week by Iranian TV, by Press TV. It'll be broadcast in this country on Monday at 4:30. You can read it, you can download it on the internet live. 4:30 Monday, Press TV. It's on Sky, I think it's on Sky as well, and you will see me for half an hour.
This is the Iranian channel.
This is Iranian national. It's Iranian government television, but it's in English, and in that half an hour, I explain my own, you know, my own position on 9/11 as a spokesperson for Reinvestigate.
So who
9/11.
Else was on that programme
then? Also Noel Glynn, who is not a spokesperson for Reinvestigate 9/11, but is a spokesperson for Quakers for Truth on Terrorism. So there's me, him, and the chap interviewing us was Derek Conway, who's a former Tory MP for somewhere in London, I think.
So can you tell us in a nutshell what kind of case you were making there?
Well, I mean, the main point I was making is that the book we were reviewing did not mention, or mentioned only in one sentence, the collapse of WTC7. And if anybody is listening, you can check this by going to your computer. WTC7 was a third building.
This is the Salomon Brothers building.
Yes.
It's part of the World Trade Center.
Well, part of the World Trade Center complex, but it collapsed into its own footprint at about 5:20 in the afternoon. The Twin Towers had gone down early in the morning.
At free fall speed. At free fall speed. Amazing,
yes,
it?
But the important thing about WTC7 is that no plane hit it. So the explanation we've been given for the collapse of the Twin Towers was that jet fuel fires caused steel to melt, which caused a catastrophic collapse into their own footprint at free fall speed.
So what's the problem with the jet fuel fires causing a
collapse? Well, I mean, leaving that aside, I leave that to architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth, and I recommend people to look at their website if they're interested in these technical matters. I just point out that no plane hit the third building, so this jet fuel fire theory simply can't be true in that case. There must be a completely different explanation. And basically, what it looks like is that all three buildings were wired with what looks like nanothermite, because some scientists have claim to have found traces of nanothermite in the rubble. This is the suspicion that all three buildings were basically blown up by nanothermite, presumably by elements within the US security
forces.
This
is an interesting type of explosive, isn't it? Because it doesn't explode in the traditional sense, like with a big bang. It's a chemical reaction where the explosive gets incredibly hot and burns very, very quickly through the metal, any metal that it's next to.
Yeah, well, Dr. Stephen Jones of the University of Utah and Dr. Nils Harriet of the University of Copenhagen have pushed their findings on this. I try to make no comment about technical matters. I leave that to the technicians. I simply point out the logical flaws in the government's explanation. First of all, the third building collapsed, no plane hit it. Why? The other major point I would make to people is we've got four airliners flying around in the most heavily defended airspace in the world, the Pentagon being the most heavily defended spot in the world, and not one of those planes was intercepted by the United States Air Force. Why ever not? In the previous 12 months, up to September the 11th, 2001, 64 planes had gone off course in US airspace. They were all intercepted within 2 to 5 minutes. Why are these planes flying around for an hour and a half and not intercepted? Simple question. And after 10 years later and a full inquiry, anybody should be able to give a one-sentence explanation. But they can't, because we haven't had one.
Now, I mentioned earlier about the BBC and CNN both announcing the collapse of this building you were talking about earlier, World Trade Center Building 7, 25 minutes before it was actually brought down by certainly what appears on all the films to be a controlled demolition into its own footprint without a plane hitting it. How is it possible for CNN and the BBC to actually say, announce the news of a collapse of a giant skyscraper when it's actually still standing in the picture behind her. Jane Stanley on BBC World is very clearly announcing this. If you go onto YouTube, you can see these clips, and the building is still upright behind her.
Well, quite probably because some American government spokesperson came to her and whispered in her ear, WTC7 is going to collapse, and she in all good faith goes on and says WTC7 has collapsed, but in actual fact they haven't quite blown it up yet. I think what happened was, like most of these kind of operations, things go wrong. Maybe a third plane was supposed to hit the tower, but it didn't. It got shot down on the way, perhaps. In which case, they've got the building wired to be blown up. There's loads of evidence inside the building which will point to the real perpetrators, so they've got to blow it up. So they hum and ha and faff around for several hours. And then Larry Silverstein, again, there's a clip of him saying, we finally took the decision to pull the building. And it's like, you what? What do you mean, to pull the building? As if it was within his power to make it collapse or not collapse. Now, again, what happens in these kind of events is there may be a plot or a conspiracy behind it, but it goes wrong. And we're able to see. It's like the Wizard of Oz, where you pull the curtain back and it's just a little man. This is what Silverstein, you know, basically giving the game away. They pulled the building. In other words, they pressed the button and blew it up, just as they pressed the button and blown up the other two, killing 3,500 people.
Now, you've just mentioned Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. There's also many other groups. I'll just go through some of them now. Scholars for 9/11 Truth and Justice. There's Lawyers for 9/11 Truth. There's Journalists and Media Professionals for 9/11 Truth. There's Firefighters for 9/11 Truth. Actors and Artists. Medical Professionals. Religious Leaders. Scientists. Professional Pilots for 9/11 Truth, which is one of the most interesting websites from my point of view. I mean, looking at many professional pilots who are very sceptical about the sort of things that you're saying. Political Leaders for 9/11 Truth. And finally, Military Officers. In fact, most of them are US military officers.
They're all US military officers.
So what is the significance of having all these various different groups? Because we'd really have heard nothing about from individuals from these groups, spokespeople from these groups in the British press. On the 10th anniversary.
Well, because we all know that Al-Qaeda carried out the attack and there's a war on terror, and that's what we know, and therefore we don't need to investigate. There's no investigation to be had, is there? Of course there is, but the mainstream media are terrified. If they start digging into this can of worms, they're going to find more and more stuff. And don't forget, basically, the BBC is ultimately a government organisation, and lots of private sector organisations are owned by wealthy people who've got a vested interest in telling fibs. So it's not surprising that it's left a community radio to dig this stuff over. Can I just recommend Military Officers for 9/11 Truth? Because they're all US military officers on that website. There's no non-US military officers on it. There's over 250 of them. One very significant one is Colonel Sabrowski, who was the we had an interview with him on some weeks ago, if you remember, and he used to be director of studies at the US Army War College. He's a Jewish American officer, and he's on the record as saying it's well known by senior leadership in the US military that 9/11 was effectively a Mossad operation. That's what he is saying. Now, maybe he's talking rubbish, but he's not a stone conspiracy theorist in his bedroom with a sad life. He used to head up the US Army War College. General Ivashov, who was the commander of the Russian armed forces on the day, people can check him, what he's saying. He says, as far as we're concerned, that was carried out by USA Mossad.
Okay, so why the disconnect then between some of these people who you think would be absolute experts on this kind of thing and the general public and through the media?
Well, don't forget, the kind of people who've done this control a great deal of power. That's why they're in a position to carry out this kind of stunt. And having carried out the stunt, they're in quite a strong position to prevent anybody asking any serious questions about it. And people say, well, how could they keep it secret? Well, how did they keep Iran-Contra secret? Well, they did. They managed it for years.
Can you just tell us what Iran-Contra was?
Well, Iran-Contra effectively... it was called Iran-Contra, that's what the media called it. Effectively what it was, a massive cocaine smuggling operation into the United States, the proceeds of which were used to fight a illegal terrorist war in Nicaragua that killed 30,000 civilians. But it was all done under the auspices of the US government. And it was kept secret for years what they were up to, but it was finally exposed. And the Iran-Contra aspect of it was that the Iranians were involved in some deal to provide weapons to the Contras in response for the release of hostages and so on. But the real meat of the Iran-Contra affair, if you look into it, was actually cocaine smuggling and terrorism in Latin America. Now, they were uncovered, but you see, what happens is we've talked about the Bologna bomb, we've talked about Iran-Contra, we've talked about the Bosco bombs of 1999, we've talked about the bombings of Dublin in 1972, we're talking now about 9/11. These events just keep happening, don't they? But each time they happen, people say, oh, what's happening? We don't understand this. People have got to get their heads around the idea that the Western intelligence services are fundamentally corrupt. They have been for decades, and we are now living with the consequences of allowing these people to run the show, and it's about time we put a stop to it.
One of the final sites is intelligence officers for 9/11 Truth. There's a whole bunch here. Ray McGovern, who was 30 years experience as an Army intelligence officer and CIA analyst, prepared the President's daily brief for Presidents Nixon, Ford and Reagan, and conducted a one-on-one morning briefings of Vice President Bush Sr. and other advisors to President Reagan. I mean, he's just one. There's also Bill Christison, who's a CIA guy, retired, Wayne Madsen, Annie Machon, Terrell E. Arnold, Annie Machon is a former MI5 officer, Senator Mike Gravel and Captain Eric H. May. I would have thought that we would have at least seen some of these intelligence, former intelligence officers speaking about the 9/11 over the 10th anniversary.
No, well, and basically, as you well know, we are not being paid for doing what we're doing here, Tony, but journalists who are paid in organisations know very well if you go down this road, it's career suicide. So they don't, by and large, and they don't even need to be told.
Okay, well, facts and myths of 9/11. I think one of the things I'd just like to put to you, in sort of round up this little section, is a lot of people are saying that by going into the minutiae of what happened on September 11th itself, things like you're talking about the collapse of this Building 7, whatever that is actually a bit of a distraction from the fact that what's going on is the war on terror, and that's what we really should be focusing on, and actually limiting the damage that that's causing to the world.
Well, I totally agree. We don't want to be making 9/11 the, you know, it's their narrative that we're being bombarded with endless programmes about 9/11 at the moment, although most of them, the serious facts are omitted. Ultimately, we've got to ask ourselves the question, why did they do it, what was the goal, and what are they going to do next? If they're capable of doing that and getting away with it, what other things are they capable of doing? And of course, we made a film, or helped to make a film about 7/7, because we think there's elements of this going on in that situation. Basically, the hour is now getting very late. We're staring into a full-on banking collapse. The intelligence services are running amok, frankly. They're out of control. And I'm afraid it's an insult to Britain's war dead in two world wars. We're just creating a hell of a mess here. And we're going to have to pull our finger out if we're going to do anything about it.
OK, well, let's get back to the September the 11th itself. And after 2 hours or so, or 90 minutes or so, of actually rescuing roughly 100 people from the World Trade Center, let's hear from the janitor. It's the guy that emptied the bins and swept up in the World Trade Center, William Rodriguez. Martin, can you just briefly tell us who William was?
Well, William came to Bristol in 2007
and spoke at Bristol.
And spoke at Bristol, where we had a very good event. He's basically for 20 years the janitor in the World Trade Center. He's originally from Puerto Rico. He basically rescued a lot of people on the day, but was feted as a hero, shook George Bush's hand. But he said, basically, I was in the basement when the first plane hit, and there were bombs in that basement. People were injured by those bombs, and then various other bombs went off in the building as it fell down. So he's an eyewitness saying, well, basically, the building was bombed.
This idea of having explosions in the World Trade Center before the collapse and before the plane hit, even, is actually, there's quite a lot of material out on there on the internet where live TV coverage, people are actually covering the attacks live, were talking about explosions all over the place. Yep. And yet that was subsequently, most of that then disappeared from the subsequent coverage.
Yeah, because what happens is you then get a narrative established, which all journalists have got to stick to. Oh, it wasn't explosions, it was aeroplane fires. And we thought it was explosions, but it was in fact aeroplane fires. So they were right the first time.
So let's go back to September the 11th itself and to the lobby of the World Trade Center, where William Rodriguez had been rescuing people and the building was just about to collapse.
Where the revolving doors were, it was just an empty space. There was nothing else there. So I make it right in the cubicle area of the entrance of that broken door. And when I stop there, I hear all of a sudden, run, run, run. It was the police. They were across the street. And I looked, and the police is running away. And I feel the floor trembling. And the only thing I see in front of the building is a fire truck. So I start running towards the fire truck saying, if this falls, it's going to kill me anyway. Because if you take the building and you put it sideways, it went all the way down to Canal Street, Chinatown. So it didn't make any sense. World Trade Center was a city within a city, 110 floors. So I said, I don't have a chance. So I ran towards the fire truck. I slid right under, and the building started to collapse right on top of the fire truck. And you hear, ba, ba, and the truck going down, 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 down. And the only thing I said at that moment was, God, please don't give my mother the pain to find my body in parts. I wanted her to recognize my body. I wanted her to at least have something to say, this is my son. And then there was a silence, and all of a sudden this dust came from all over. Remember that dust everybody running away from? That huge cloud of dust? I was in the middle. I was getting that dust, burning me every possible way. When you get into a trouble, you have to control your breathing, your thoughts, and relax. So I did that. And I expected death. I knew I was going to die. Luckily, from across the street, there was CNN, Globovision from Brazil, a television station from Brazil. They were filming, and they said, the last man out came out in that area. They pinpointed the area. And that's how they started the rescue effort. And that's how I got, later on, pulled out from the rubble.
That was the janitor in the World Trade Center who emptied the bins and swept up. William Rodriguez speaking at Bristol back in 2007. Now, Martin, many people, because he talks about explosions almost in the building before the plane hit and also before it came down, they talk about him as a conspiracy theorist.
Well, he's just a witness, isn't he? I mean, if that's what you heard, I heard explosions, and they can say, well, he may be mistaken, but they can hardly say that he's a conspiracy theorist. He's just saying what happened as far as he was concerned. And he did give evidence to the inquiry, none of which was used, as did several other people. Basically, the inquiry was a whitewash. Think the Savile inquiry into Bloody Sunday and so on. The government didn't want an inquiry in the US. They only had one because groups like the Jersey Girls, who represented three bereaved widows, pushed for it. And eventually they just tried to close it down. Senator Max Cleland, who was a Vietnam veteran, lost both his legs and an arm in Vietnam. He wheelchaired out in disgust, saying this is a whitewash. And basically we need a proper investigation because there's a prima facie case for the intelligence services being the culprits. Now, they may be not the culprits, but if you want to shut up people like us talking about it, you've got to prove that they weren't the culprits, not just assume it. Because we know that they do things like this. They've done them in the past. They could easily be doing them on this case. And they could do them again unless we catch them. And we've got a pretty good idea of who we're looking for.
Okay, William Rodriguez again then. Let's hear from him speaking at Bristol back in 2007.
I live on donations. I live on, right now, selling my DVD. That's how I pay my basic life expenses. But I go around the world with the blessing of the families, because they want this information to be available to you, because the same way that they have used 9/11, they can use 7/7. They can use in Madrid, the Madrid bombing. So for you to be aware how they use this kind of event as a power grabbing system. We don't have the great student movement that we had in the 60s, that we changed the world. Remember that great civil rights movement that we have all over the world? We don't have that anymore. So please, take it upon yourself. Take it upon your consciousness to question what they're selling you. Even take doubt on what I'm telling you. Because I want you to do your own research. I want you to go on the internet, go on the libraries, go everywhere and get the right information. And only that way we can change our world for the better. And we can make it better. But it's up to us. We cannot be anymore the MTV couch potato. We have to do the right thing. We owe it to their families. We owe it to the victims. So God bless you and thank you for being here. I really appreciate it.
That's William Rodriguez at the end of his talk that he gave back in 2007. Martin, he's talking there really about people having to go out and be almost like journalists themselves.
Yeah, I think that's the great hope, is the what you might call crowd wisdom. Basically, there are lots of people going through all of this with a fine-tooth comb. Some of them get the wrong end of the stick, frankly, because they don't really know what they're looking for, and they come up with what are basically silly theories. But what we've actually got is a documented historical record of Western intelligence services and others engaging in these kind of false flag terrorist events. It seems to be a fairly standard procedure. Blow something up, kill somebody, blame it on somebody else. then use the resulting fear to create more power to the power structures that you're trying to reinforce. It's a pretty straightforward idea, really, and one has to basically investigate everything. Don't believe what you are told. I mean, Nazi Germany was falling, it's in The World at War. This guy remembers he remembers Goebbels on the radio. He was a small boy at the time, and Goebbels was saying, "Germany will win the war." And he turned to his father and said, "That's rubbish." And his father said, "Goebbels wouldn't lie to us at a time like this." He said, "One week later, the Russians arrived." Now, that just shows how gullible people want to be. Because in actual fact, if the Western Intelligence Services carried out 9/11, that's a gauntlet thrown down to every father and mother in this country and every other country. How are you going to live in a world where people can do this and get away with it? Are you going to do something about it?
Well, after, this is going back to 2007, after William had finished his talk, I had a chat to him about how the events of September the 11th had actually affected him spiritually. Back to 2007 and at Bristol, and this is William Rodriguez, who was a janitor in the World Trade Center, and he was speaking to me just after his chat that you were just hearing from.
I was totally agnostic. I didn't want to deal with anything religiously or spiritually. I figured it was just a whole, you know, mythological creation of the mind. And 9/11, after I experienced that life-changing experience, because during all the difficult moments of my ordeal in the building, I kept praying, and every prayer was answered.
Well, that's strange for someone who actually doesn't believe.
Correct.
To be praying.
Correct. And for example, when the two people were stuck on an elevator in the basement, I was saying, "God, please help me." And I was like even surprised that I said that, but I said it with such a devotion and sincerity in my heart that, you know, I found a pipe in an area that was supposed to be clean of construction debris. I found a ladder to go and get these people while all the ladders were always chained up against a wall so nobody would steal them. The longest one of all of them was there waiting for me to save these people. I mean, one thing after the other. And just to make it shorter, the most important one is when the building is collapsing. I said, "God, please don't give my mother the pain to see my body in parts. Let her recognize my body." And I realized that I never asked anything for me. I asked always for somebody else. And in a way, I guess God gave me a second opportunity from that moment on, because he said, you know, he's not asking anything for himself. So let me protect him. And he protected me all the way through. And even when I was pulled from the rubble, having a whole building on top of me in pieces, I didn't break a bone. You know, I got, you know, burns and wounds, but I did not break one single bone, while everybody would have been squashed to death. So I believe from that moment on that I did have a special relationship with God at that very moment, that I have a line of communication that not everybody had at that moment, and I was chosen to get this message out. I was chosen to do this mission. I was chosen to take upon these forces that are going against the families, the affected, and the survivors, and also the world, and expose them for what they are, liars. You know, I have nothing to gain for this. I was even homeless last year. I was living under a bridge, even though I was on TV every day. Every day. People didn't even know. And, you know, I never stopped my message, my mission. It was always there. And I guess he's now saying, well, you know, well, he's doing the right thing, because, you know, he's opening the doors. He opened the doors for me to meet the top political figures of the world. And they all have listened to me face to face. And that's something that I would never, as a janitor, expected that it will happen in my lifetime. I just received an award, the Lifetime Achievement Award, by the Latino Pride Organization, which is the biggest one in the United States. And the person that gave me the award was William Lora, the president of CNN. And what a surprise of getting that from the same people that kind of censors me. It is very amazing. So this is a privilege to be doing this fight, but I'm not doing it for myself. I'm doing it because it's the only way I can glorify that second opportunity that God gave me to be alive. So he gave me this opportunity, and I'm just saying thank you by doing the work that I do.
Was there any one event on 9/11 that really convinced you and made you feel that God was close to you on that day? Any one particular event?
Yeah, when I went under the truck, that specific moment. Because, you know, if I think about all the things that happened, he was with me through the whole ordeal. Because I could have died on the explosion in the basement. I didn't. He gave me the strength to put a man twice my size on my back and take him out of the building and save his life while everybody else have to follow me, those 15 people in general, so I could take them and lead them to salvation on that day. And then to go back and open the elevator, find the way to practically pull two people again from an elevator filled of water and bring these two people out again, and then go floor by floor opening the doors so people could escape. Yes, he was with me all the way because I felt protected. I felt that while everybody's screaming, everybody, I was in total control. But not because I wanted to be in control, it's because I was in desperation. And people don't understand that my fear kicked in when I heard noises on the 34th floor. That's when I was afraid. What's going on here? I heard very strange movement on a floor that was empty, and I bypassed that floor. It was the only moment through the whole ordeal that I felt afraid. And when I get to the 39th floor and the other tower gets hit, and I hear the internal collapse in our building, and I start going down, I figured, you know, this is a scene from the Tower in Inferno. There's chunks coming all over and nothing is hitting us. We are protected all the way to the to the base of the building, to the lobby. So yes, I believe that God really protected me and all the way. And the culmination was when the building collapsed.
Does that affect the way you do things now, your life now, do you think?
Oh, it affects everything in my life. I am very grateful for the privilege of this second opportunity to be alive. I am not religious. You know, you don't see me preaching religion to anybody, but I have a personal relationship directly connected with God because, you know, it's not every day that you survive an event of this magnitude. This is the catalytic event that have changed the history of the new millennium. And to have this privilege, because it's a privilege to have the second opportunity. And some people say, don't you feel that you are wasting that privilege because you are exposing these people and putting yourself out there to be killed practically? I say, no, on the opposite. I believe that the privilege is like, well, I do it in a shorter version. A lot of people that survive major catastrophes, they always die of the most stupid and banal things. For example, they will cut a nail, they get an infection, and they died. What did they do after they survived something to that moment? They just enjoy life. I cannot enjoy life. Why? I got married. My wife is totally... She's suffering. She's suffering for the kind of work that I do because she don't want to lose me. But she understand that this is a mission. So I believe... And if they, for example, they give me that award, that Lifetime Achievement Award, you say, well, why am I getting this? It's because in 5 years, you have done what it takes somebody else a lifetime to achieve. Legislations, recognitions, benefits for the community, not only related to 9/11, but other issues as well. I became an activist, and an activist, what they do is to protect the interests of the community. And that's exactly what I'm doing. So, life-changing? Oh, completely.
William Rodriguez there, who was the janitor in the World Trade Center on the day of September 11th, 2001, speaking to me back in 2007 after his talk that he did at Bristol when he did his UK tour. Now, Martin, we're going to go on now and look at a chap called David Ray Griffin. He's an author. Why is he significant?
Well, he's actually an emeritus professor of theology. I believe he's a Methodist, and he's written some of the most well-researched books on 9/11, including The New Pearl Harbor, which is the one I've read. Basically, he's a fairly reliable person in terms of his analysis of what happened. He doesn't add too much in, he doesn't take too much out, he sticks to the facts. And because he's a trained mind, you know, I mean, he's a clever guy, so he doesn't make silly mistakes as he presents his argument.
Yes, and he's doing hearings over this weekend in Toronto, I see. So let's have a little listen now to David Ray Griffin.
Why is the theologian one of the primary speakers for this cause? Do you see any religious or spiritual implications for 9/11, and what are they?
What we theologians are supposed to be doing is trying to imagine and speak about the world from the divine point of view. And if the religions of the world are basically correct, the divine is the creator and lover of all peoples, in fact, all creatures, and cares about the good of the world, the long-term good of the world, and wouldn't want people producing nuclear wars that would decimate all life on the planet, wouldn't want global warming to continue after 30 years after we've known about it, 35 years now, about the ecological crisis, wouldn't want all these things. So I'm convinced that this administration is the most dangerous administration we have ever had for the future of this country. And the future of the world. And if trying to save God's planet is not a religious issue, I wouldn't know what was. Thank you for the question.
That was David Ray Griffin speaking a couple of years ago, actually. But he's just got a book out, Martin, called 9/11, 10 Years Later, When State Crimes Against Democracy Succeed. So what happens when state crimes against democracy succeed?
You end up with World War III if we're not careful. And I'm afraid we're on the slippery slope as we speak. The economy's on the ropes. There's all kinds of trouble all over the world. Even if we started doing the right things tomorrow, we've got a hell of a fight on our hands.
Now, also, there's something called the Department of Peace Studies up at Bradford University, and Professor Paul Rogers was recently speaking about the effects that 9/11 have had on the world since then.
In the appalling atrocities in 11 September, nearly 3,000 people died. Since then, for every person killed there, 80 have died, 225,000 in Iraq, Afghanistan, and elsewhere. And it looks like the United States may still have troops in Afghanistan in another 12 or 14 years' time. We're into a kind of never-ending war. The extraordinary thing is that the more troops have gone in over the last 3 years, the more the violence has actually escalated. So it seems to be a counterproductive move.
What about that final point that Paul Rogers, who's in charge of the Department of Peace Studies at Bradford University, is making there, Martin, about this kind of endless war?
Well, that's the whole point of this, isn't it? There's no point at which we could say we've won. We supposedly killed Osama bin Laden the other week, although most people in Pakistan and in the world at large don't believe that for a moment, and nor do I. But that hasn't brought it to an end, because it couldn't bring it to an end. This is, you know, it's like if you have a war on an abstract noun, that's what I'm looking for, then you're never going to succeed, are you? Because you know, terrorism is just basically a political tactic, and you're not going to make a political tactic go away by having a war on it, just as you're not going to make drugs go away by having a war on them.
But what happens when you've got, you know, sort of Department of Peace Studies people against this big behemoth like the military-industrial complex? It's not really an equal battle, is it?
No, it's not, and that's why we need to look at towards the military officers for 9/11 truth, because they're the ones with the guns, ultimately. I would see this as being basically a fight. It's already a fight. You ask the Afghans, you ask the Iraqis. Ultimately, I'm putting my money on the professionalism of the armed forces in the United States of America. Sort these people out. It's your job. That's what you're paid to do. If you find that your people have been blowing up your own people in order to start a war, well, sort them out. You're paid to do it. Get on with it.
Now, since 9/11, there's been a big increase in one particular branch of the United States military. It's called JSOC, Joint Special Operations Command. committee or commission. Can you just tell us a bit about the significance of that? Because we heard about from Seymour Hersh many, 4 or 5 years ago now, that Dick Cheney was using this to assassinate people, this particular branch of the military.
Well, basically, it's Dick Cheney's death squad is what we're talking about here. Don't forget that Homeland Security, as I said earlier, employs up to 1 million people in the United States now. There's masses and masses of little organisations. The same thing happened with the KGB. It was fragmented into hundreds and hundreds of different little organisations, all of which were unaccountable and nobody knew what they were. Ultimately, what you want to have in your intelligence structure is transparency to the leadership, so that you have one big organisation which jumps when it's told to jump, not thousands and thousands of organisations all doing different things, many of them possibly engaged in commissioning terrorism rather than catching people involved in it. Look at the Underpants bomber. We've got eyewitnesses who were on the plane saying that he was Laurie Haskell, who was a top lawyer, and his wife saying, well, the guy just walked onto the plane without going through security at all. These are the kind of things that need to be looked into properly.
Now, so who is it that would allow something like that to take place? I mean, the security...
Well, the security at Schiphol Airport is in the hands of an Israeli security company, because, of course, privatisation means that it's not in the hands of the Dutch anymore. We've outsourced it. And, of course, the Israelis are experts in counter-terrorism, so they often get the contracts, just as they got the contract, Veritas Systems, Mossad Link Company got the contract to run the CCTV footage in the London Underground. And they're all the same... firm, which I think it's called ICTS, I can't remember the exact term of it, people have to, I haven't got it with me. The same Israeli security firm runs the security at Schiphol and the security in all three airports involved in the 9/11 attacks. I think that rates a don't you?
Right, well, let's have a listen now to this report on JSOC, this branch of the US military, which has massively expanded since the September the 11th attacks.
It's called the Joint Special Operations Command, otherwise known as JSOC. The organization started out in 1980, but its numbers have exploded from 1,800 troops before 9/11 to now more than 20,000. The group's main objective is to carry out the U.S.'s war on terror. Behind the scenes, it often includes the imprisonment and interrogation of dozens of suspects, occasionally holding them in jails that it alone controls in Iraq and Afghanistan. All operations are said to be signed off on by the President, the Secretary of Defense, and top lawmakers.
They will advise some very, very senior members of the Senate and House Intelligence Committees, but not the rank and file, simply because of the concern for leaks.
According to a Washington Post article, a U.S. president can give JSOC the rare authority to select individuals for a kill list, and then to kill rather than capture them. Critics charge that these targeted missions equal assassination, a practice prohibited by U.S. law. According to official documents, members of JSOC are responsible for carrying out hundreds of raids that have killed scores of people deemed as enemy combatants. Some of those who were killed or injured in these raids have been bestowed with the highest of combat honors, the Purple Heart. JSOC can sometimes operate more secretively than the CIA, designed to be quick, stealthy, and efficient. It can carry out missions such as eliminating America's former most wanted.
Osama bin Laden was one example of that. And in fact, they drew people from the JSOC, specially trained them for months, so they became an inner core of the core.
Known to many as SEAL Team 6. Experts on JSOC write that two presidents and three secretaries of defense requested operations in Iraq and Afghanistan, but also Yemen, Pakistan, Somalia, the Philippines, Nigeria, and Syria. But they say that Mexico affairs could soon join the list of JSOC objectives. Colin Campbell, Press TV, Washington.
Yes, that was Colin Campbell at Press TV with that report from a few weeks ago. Martin, why is it that we're only hearing this kind of thing from Press TV and we're not hearing about JSOC or from almost anywhere else?
Well, I mean, it's available on the internet for those who are interested. I mean, don't forget, we've got to compete with X Factor here. So, you know, we've got a bit of a problem getting people to get their heads around JSOC. What's interesting about Navy, the SEAL Team 6 is that they're all dead, because they died supposedly in a helicopter, not accident, it was supposedly shot down by the Taliban a couple of weeks ago.
Well, you say supposedly. Why do you say that?
Well, because we've got eyewitnesses from Abbottabad who say that there was only one helicopter involved in the Abbottabad incident, as I call it, and that crashed into a wall as it was taking off from the compound, and everybody on it died. Which is completely different from the story we've been told by the US government. I mean, people all around the world will have seen the picture of Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama supposedly watching a live feed from Abbottabad, and then they had to admit later on that there was no live feed and that they were just play-acting. Now, When senior politicians play act about this stuff, I smell a rat.
Now, we've just seen the overthrow of the military dictator, Colonel Gaddafi, in Libya. But you seem to be painting a picture of a very, very powerful military here in the Western world. And possibly you could even describe it as more powerful than our elected government.
Looks like it, doesn't it? I mean, the politicians, let's face it, are mostly bought and paid for. In order to get elected, even if they mean well, they have to raise funds, and the people they get the funds from are the people who make the money out of the military industry, which funds their political campaigns.
Well, I'm sure some of the MPs we have on this show would disagree with you there, say no one's paid for me.
Well, they may say that, but ultimately, if we have an election, maybe a snap election if the economy collapses, the Labour Party in Britain is £10 million in debt, so somehow they will have to raise the money to fight an election, and no doubt there will be strings attached to that money. And that's just the way the world works as it stands at the moment. We've got to change that. In Scandinavia, that wouldn't be the way. In Norway, it wouldn't be the way. But we don't live in Norway, do we?
So do you think the leaders of our political parties are really up to actually taking on some of these issues?
I think the leaders of our main political parties are basically ignorant about most of this stuff. They're terrified of the security services. They just, their eyes go like saucers whenever they're mentioned. They just say, "Oh, I don't really know anything about that." And but there's a whole area that we can't go into. It's like, well, no, it's not that difficult. I mean, of course, the exception to this would, of course, be politicians in Northern Ireland who know very well that security services are like whatever side they're on, and they have no delusions about them. I think that, you know, basically a lot of our politicians really don't understand how the world works. They're very low-level people. The real secret government grinds on while they basically argue about the deck chairs on the Titanic.
Okay, and also, I mean, you're talking about the September the 11th attacks and possibly others. We heard William talking about Madrid. We've also talked about the 7/7 London bombings as false flag attacks. Can you just remind us, where does that term come from?
It's originally from 18th century naval warfare. Captain Cochrane was very famous for his false flag attacks. He was the hero of Master and Commander, that film that was shown a few years ago. Basically, a false flag attack is you sail towards your enemy flying a flag, like Cochrane used to fly Spanish flags. As he sailed towards Spanish ships, they, oh, it's a Spanish ship, that's fine. And then when you get up close, you run up your own flag and you take them by surprise. And also, basically, what happens is you carry out an atrocity and then you blame it on your enemy. So gangs and counter gangs, which is Frank Kitson's book written about who's Brigadier Frank Kitson, who basically does British Army counterinsurgency doctrine. Basically, you carry out atrocities and blame them on the enemy. So in Rhodesia, for example, the Seller Scouts would massacre local villages and blame it on the guerrillas and so on.
So, I mean, if this has happened in the past, it's likely to happen again. What criteria can we use to predict this kind of act, before it happens, and then actually judge it when it does?
I think you shouldn't jump to judgment about any act. Not all terrorism is false flag terrorism. Some of it is genuinely carried out by those who carried it out, like most of the IRA's attacks. But on the other hand, don't presume that you're being told the truth, because often you're not.
Well, that's all for this week. Thanks very much to Martin Summers and the guest in the first hour, who is Lib Dem councillor, but he's still Steve Comer. And see you next week, when we'll be looking at some of the results of 9/11 and questioning this term, the New World Order.
From the Sky News Centre at 7. As America prepares to mark 10 years since 9/11, there's a credible and specific threat of another terrorist attack. People in New York are being warned to be vigilant, but memorial services at Ground Zero will go ahead as planned on Sunday. US Secretary of State Hillary Clinton says it proves the very real threat that terrorist groups pose.
It is a continuing reminder of the stakes in our struggle against violent extremism. No matter who propagates it, no matter where it comes from, no matter who its targets might be.
A teenager has been charged with the attempted murder of a schoolboy just yards away from a recent fatal stabbing. The 15-year-old was attacked in Edmonton in North London on Wednesday. It's just a week since a man was killed there when he complained at youths who threw conkers at him. A negotiator has told the inquest into the death of Raoul Moat he tried to stop the gunman killing himself. The court also heard transcripts of tapes Moat recorded while on the run, in which he likened himself to King Kong. Our reporter Catherine